we are seeing more and more closures every day. It seems to be that this oil now is spreading more to the west, which is west of the Mississippi River.
An oil spill worsens in the Gulf of Mexico. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 10th of May. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, remembering Alaska visionary Wally Hickel.
Just before he died, he called me and said, "Malcolm, get the job done. Get the job done."
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. In Alaska, more than 2,000 children are in need of foster homes, and more than 1,200 of those children are Alaska Native. These children need homes where they can learn who they are. Alaska Native foster homes can help pass on traditions, arts, and culture. Help keep Alaska's children safe and their heritage strong. Learn more at 800-478-7307. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The failure of BP's plan to cap a gushing underground oil leak in the Gulf of Mexico has only exacerbated concerns about the eventual magnitude of the spill. Efforts to cap the leak failed over the weekend when ice crystals jammed a containment box designed to cover the leak, which is about a mile underwater. Gulf of Mexico shrimp fishermen were the first to feel the impacts of the spill. John Williams is executive director of the Southern Shrimp Alliance in Tarpon Springs, Florida.
It's very scary. You know, it doesn't seem to be an end in sight. They tried to contain the spill with that big dome. Apparently that didn't work, so now they're going back to the drawing board, and they're still, I assume that they're drilling the relief well, which they're still saying take another 80 to 90 days. We're praying that they can contain this long before then.
He says the situation is getting worse every day. Williams says initial shrimp closures didn't come until days after the explosion of an oil rig in late April, which set events in motion. At first, only about 5% of Gulf shrimp fishing grounds were closed due to the spill.
But now, as they fail to contain this blowout, we are seeing more and more closures every day. It seems to be that this oil now is spreading more to the west, which is west of the Mississippi River, which is causing a lot of the Louisiana coastline to be closed to not only to shrimping, but to all fishing.
The huge oil slick on the surface is being fed by a 200,000-gallon-a-day oil leak. Meanwhile, Alaska fishermen are watching news reports of the Gulf spill with concern and with sympathy. Mark Vinsel is executive director of United Fishermen of Alaska.
We stand hand in hand with those fishermen, and our hearts go out to them in this loss and this tragedy, and we're keeping up with a few things. The governor's office and Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute are providing expertise in dealing with the ramifications of these, and we're keeping tracks with what we might be able to do to help down there.
Ironically, a Prince William Sound spot shrimp fishery opened in mid-April for the first time in 21 years. Fisheries manager Bob Berselli says sound shrimpers hauled in about 34% of the commercial harvest limit of 55,000 pounds before they lost interest in the fishery to prepare for salmon season. Beam trawl and pot shrimp fisheries are open in southeast Alaska, too, but Vincent says Alaska's small shrimp harvests never posed competition for Gulf of Mexico shrimp anyway, so Alaska shrimp markets most likely will not feel a boost from Gulf closures. But Vinsel says southern shrimpers will face big challenges selling their product now.
So you have to make sure that the fish are tested for what they actually contain and do your best to keep the quality up. I think the Copper River people have done a good job of that down in Cordova and made sure that they're marketing what they actually have instead of people's perception that may not be correct.
Williams says Gulf fishermen are going to work on spill containment for the time being, but what the future will bring is not clear.
Most every state agency plus the federal agency, NOAA Fisheries and FDA and all the state agencies are certainly monitoring. They're taking baseline samples of prior to the blowout and prior to the affected areas to get a baseline on the quality of the fish and shrimp and crab, but it's hard to project what will happen, you know, because, like I say, it's unfolding every day. We don't know what the marketing will be. There will be a public perception, you know, that seafood from the Gulf is bad, but that's certainly far from being the case. We will adjust our marketing plans accordingly.
Vince Ull says the Alaska Fishing Industry Relief Mission is standing by to see what it can do to help southern fishermen. The relief mission was formed after Hurricane Katrina, when Alaska seafood industry representatives donated time and money to send a traveling boat lift from Valdez to help recover boats blown inland by the storm. Former Governor Wally Hickel, elected twice to the state's highest office, died Friday night, the result of a heart attack he had earlier last week. He was 90 years old. Hickel was elected as the state's second governor in 1966 and returned to office in 1990. He also served as the U.S. Secretary of the Interior for the Nixon administration from 1969 to 1970. APRN's Dave Donaldson has more.
As a 20-year-old who had won the Golden Gloves welterweight division boxing title in his native Kansas, Wally Hickel took a ship to Alaska in 1940, arriving in Anchorage with 37 cents in his pocket. He often told the story of that voyage, staring at the beauty that he saw, and one day, looking out a small porthole of the ship, he made a pact with Alaska. "Take care of me," he said, "and I'll take care of you." Both sides honored that moment, and Wally Hickel kept up a fast pace. In an interview 2 years ago following a visit to Beijing, he said there was still too much left to do.
"I'm going up to heaven. I'm going to tell St. Peter, if you don't have a spot for me, send me back. I'm not through yet."
He became a builder, not just houses and offices and hotels like his Captain Cook Hotel in Anchorage, but a state. He was strong, busy, and dedicated to improving the world around him, taking an early role in the fight for Alaska's statehood efforts. The economy was next. There was oil at Prudhoe Bay, and he wanted it developed. And to get it, he accepted the offer from Richard Nixon to go to Washington, D.C. to take on the oil industry.
"You know, they weren't going to build an oil line. And I'll never forget, President Nixon called. He had seen me when I paddled back to Washington when Truman was President, Eisenhower. And he called me right after he was elected. And he says, 'Wally, you've got to become Secretary of Interior.' I said, 'No, I'm too busy. I need time to make a living, because when I work on this stuff, nobody pays me anything.' And so he told me I wouldn't get that oil line unless I come back there. And we wouldn't have got the oil line because they weren't going to drill in Prudhoe Bay."
The battles began immediately after he took the federal office, when an oil rig blew out just offshore in Santa Barbara, California. He told Union Oil, the owner of the rig that pumped 100,000 gallons of crude into the water, to clean up the beaches and the water. He meant it, and he got it. In doing that, he also showed his commitment to the environment. Despite his reputation as a builder and his recognition of the need to develop the state's resources, as Secretary of the Interior, he had the job of protecting the nation's land and water. In his last act in that office, November 25, 1970, he put all 8 species of great whales on the endangered species list. Since then, many of those have come back, and with obvious pride, he recently said they're now healthy populations. He said he'd gone against the wishes of Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, and against, surprising even to him, the National Aeronautic and Space Administration, that used whale oil in space vehicles.
"Took the whale, and they said they were going to take the whale for." I says, "Well, what are you going to do when you run out of whale oil?" "Said, we'll have to find a substitute." "Well, you're going to find a substitute now, because I'm going to put the whale on the endangered species list." And that's how I stopped it.
He never saw his final dream, a natural gas pipeline from the North Slope to Valdez, where gas would be liquefied and shipped overseas. It came about when then-Governor Jay Hammond asked Hickel and former Governor Egan to help get the project started. His last international trip was to Asia to encourage markets that would lead to the construction of the project. Bill Walker of Valdez went on the trip with him 2 years ago this weekend.
"One of his favorite sayings, he would say, ideas are much more important than money. You know, my last meeting with him, about 10 days ago. The last thing he said as I left his office, we shook hands, and he said, go build that pipeline. And so it was always on his mind, and it was always certainly the center of our discussion every time that we sat down and discussed what was happening in the state.
Although he was a national figure in Republican Party politics, he was not tied to the party. He was elected to a second term as governor under the Alaska Independence Party banner. Although he frequently joked about never having read their party platform and disagreeing with their principal goal of secession. He worked as well with Democrats as Republicans, proudly talking about the Democrats he had voted for, including Barack Obama. He often advised and worked with Democrat Ethan Berkowitz over the years.
I can't think of anyone who is more true to the North and more true to Alaska than Wally Hickel. His whole idea that we were unique and that you had to be bold and had to have vision, it goes beyond any kind of party politics. It's the kind of thing that appeals to all of us that makes this state a truly unique and wonderful place to live.
Berkowitz shared his observation of many Alaskans. Whatever the title before his name, secretary, governor, chairman, to Alaskans, he was always Wally. He was always the kid who had been a boxer, and he was always one of us. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, making it in the big city after life in rural Alaska.
We're still going to have to leave the villages, and there's a lucky few that can go back. The rest of us are just kind of here in Anchorage.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. Attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
Malcolm Roberts began working for Interior Secretary Wally Hickel in 1970. He then followed Hickel to Alaska after both were fired by President Nixon. Roberts has worked as an assistant to Wally Hickel ever since. His 40-year career by the former governor's side gives him unique insight into his legacy. He told APRN's Dave Donaldson, Hickel was a true visionary with an impressive reach.
In November, I represented him along with his son, Dr. Jack Hickel, at a conference in South Africa where thinkers and activists are wrestling with how Africa can find a way out of this cycle of outside interests controlling resources, often paying off local politicians and the people staying in poverty. And they wanted us to present Wally Hickel's vision of the owner state that Alaska has been pioneering of a democracy with a free enterprise economy, but in which the people co-own the land and the resources. That's the ownership piece. And our Constitution insists that our resources must be developed for the maximum benefit of the people. Well, that took that conference by storm, Dave. It was just absolutely amazing. Wally believed that God didn't put on this earth the resources just for a few people or corporations, but for all people. And if we used the Alaska approach, there would be no legitimate reason for poverty on this earth.
He once said that it is the respect for the commons that makes private property possible. The idea is that if you don't have a recognition of what is everyone's, then you can't recognize what is anyone's specific private property.
I haven't heard that thought before, but Wally certainly believed in private property and honoring private property. But when it comes to natural resource wealth, what upset him as he traveled the world was seeing people, which he called poor people living on rich land. And he says, that's what I discovered when I came to Alaska in 1940 as a young man. The state was terribly exploited by outside interests. And so that was his passion and his focus, how to help people benefit from the natural resources of their country.
Beyond the commons, the economics, and those particular issues, Wally was very involved as an environmentalist. He was respectful and responsible for it.
Well, you know, it's hard to pigeonhole Wally Hickel. He was not a developer. He was not an environmentalist. He was interested in what was real and what helped people and what helped the environment. And he didn't run from some political party platform or some line of thinking. He always looked at things as what is real and what is best for the people and the environment. And he believed that if we could unite the people who cared about the environment with those who care about pulling people out of poverty, then we can have a better and a fairer world.
They don't recognize the synergy that he did.
Yes, and you know, just before he died, he called me and said, "Malcolm, get the job done. Get the job done." And he said that to a number of those, including his son, Jack Hickel, who's working in Africa, that he meant, you know, get the word out, that this is not about one nation. It's not about one race. It's about all peoples and all nations.
Malcolm Roberts was an assistant to Wally Hickel for 40 years. He spoke with APRN's Dave Donaldson. As governor, Wally Hickel introduced a pragmatic approach to his vision for Alaska. His idea that big dreams lead to big results was frequently tempered at times by a recognition of what was possible. Coming out of the gubernatorial campaign, the public expected him to follow the team of people who helped put him in office, people who wanted to make substantial changes in the state's government and structure to fulfill their own agendas. Bruce Botello, who began that term as the head of the Department of Law's Oil and Gas section and ended it as Attorney General, noticed Hickel was at first constrained by that approach because of the governor's natural inclination to trust people he worked with.
He'd like to describe himself, and I think it was probably true, a person pure in heart. That's not the language that politicians would generally use today, but he could say that without embarrassment.
Botello says the governor recognized that he needed to be personally in charge of his reputation. He says Hickel evolved as issues came up and were dealt with.
Governor Hickel in 1990 and Governor Hickel in 1994 had changed. And I think it's the basis of his abiding sense of pragmatism in how to govern.
His second term as governor was highlighted by a continuation of his encounters with the oil industry, for example, settling the state's claims against Exxon for the Exxon Valdez oil spill and collection of billions of dollars in past due taxes. It also brought about settlement of a 12-year-old lawsuit that led to the establishment of the Mental Health Trust.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. Does your child not look at you when you talk to him? Are you worried your child doesn't play with other children? Or do you wonder why your child seems to be in her own world? Well, these could be the early signs of autism. For more information about autism and resources in your community, visit autism.alaska.gov or call 1-800-799-7570. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Low water may not seem like a flood danger, but that is exactly the problem for one village on the Kuskokwim River right now. The village of Red Devil is experiencing some minor flooding because ice is jammed on an exposed sandbar. National Weather Service hydrologist Ben Bach says that shifting ice sheets are to blame.
We're finding out that the when sheets start to move, they get hung up on sandbars or on the heads of islands. There's just not enough water to lift these sheets around these islands. And even though there's very little water overall in the river system this year, it doesn't take much of a jam to temporarily cause water to back up.
Water is covering a few roads and a couple of portions of Red Devil's runway. There have been just a few ice flows on the Kuskokwim this year. Bach says without a push from mountain runoff, most ice is just rotting in place. Andrea Gusty and Marta Montine both left rural Alaska for college knowing they were not likely to return. Now in Anchorage, they grapple with the fact that sometimes building a career means leaving the rural way of life. Michelle Terrio reports.
Growing up in Western Alaska, Andrea Gusty was certain of a few things. She would go to college, and she would leave the state to do it.
I was born in Bethel, and I grew up in Aniak on the Kuskokwim River. I think when I grew up, it was about 600 people, and I knew it was never a question that I would go to college.
After high school, Andrea went to Northwestern University outside of Chicago to study journalism. She was homesick, but she was also on a mission.
The whole reason behind wanting to be a journalist was to really kind of tell the story that I had never heard growing up in Alaska and never saw in the news.
But after she graduated, fulfilling her dream of covering Native issues in the mainstream media meant another certainty for Andrea, living in a city, not a village. Now she's an award-winning investigative reporter for a local TV station. She lives in an apartment in the asphalt heart of Midtown Anchorage. She's not alone. The way she sees it, the lack of jobs in rural areas will force many young Alaska Natives into the city.
We're still going to have to leave the villages, and there's the lucky few that can go back. But the rest of us are just kind of here in Anchorage, and we have to, you know, kind of keep one foot in two different worlds.
For Marta Montine, who grew up in Nome and has family in Norvik, leaving was about education and experiencing the broader world.
I felt like I wanted to get some experience outside of Alaska, and so that's when I decided to pursue out-of-state education and just get a bigger exposure to the U.S. and the world.
After college in Colorado and Canada, going home didn't seem like an option. She says it's a pretty common story among her friends.
I see that and I recognize that as well as far as the whole idea of brain drain of, you know, you need to leave the community to get higher education to gain skills, you know, in whatever field you want to apply in your community. And I don't think I was ready to go back home and to move back home.
Now she works at an Anchorage nonprofit. Beyond Borders works on community development in rural Alaska. It makes her think a lot about Nome, where her sister still lives. Her life and career are here, but she wants to feel connected.
I think it kind of touches on the identity issue a little bit of wanting to hold on to cultural stuff, cultural ties and language.
But she recently got married and she's earning a degree in social work. For the immediate future, Anchorage is home, and Nome is a place that she visits.
I'm always trying to promote people to gain some understanding about the reality of rural Alaska and what's faced. I mean, the joys and everything good and the challenges and the struggles. And I'll be taking my husband to Norvik this summer to go to fish camp and hang out, so it'll be fun.
Both Marta and Andrea miss life in rural Alaska, but have no plans to move back. Andrea's mom, Cheryl Jarabek, still lives in Aniak. She says she understands why her daughter's life and career is in Anchorage.
I mean, this is where she needs to be. And I'm also prepared for if at some point in her profession she decides to be not in the state. I mean, you know, you want your child to be successful and happy and things like that.
But for Andrea, finding success in the city can be conflicting and even wrenching.
It's kind of funny because my mother told me this story of somebody who came up to her in the village and said something to the effect of, sorry. Said something that wasn't meant to. Wasn't meant to be a criticism necessarily, but said something along the lines of, oh, you know, in the last couple years, Andrea's really changed. In the last couple of years, Andrea's really changed. She's really become cityfied.
She says that until village life includes jobs, affordable energy, and schools, more young people like her will leave.
But with so many people leaving the village at these high rates, what's the incentive for the state or federal government to bring low-cost energy? If there's 50 people left in a village, why spend $10 million to bring them sustainable energy? But people have to keep leaving until that happens, so I don't know.
She hopes it won't always be that way. When she anchors the evening news, Andrea often wears an Athabascan caribou tuft pin or a necklace made by a Yupik artist. It's her way, she says, of letting the people watching from the village know that she remembers exactly where she comes from. In Anchorage, I'm Michelle Terrio.
The American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska is proceeding with a lawsuit to prevent further raids of homeless camps in the Anchorage municipality. The ACLU had hoped to reach an agreement with the municipality over the destruction of the camps and disposal of property belonging to the homeless. But the ACLU's Jeffrey Mittman says no agreement was reached protecting the constitutional rights of the homeless. Meanwhile, a new drama in Fairbanks explores the experience of homeless teens. The original work, Alice in the Underground, is a production of Fairbanks Counseling and Adoption Services Street Outreach and Advocacy Program. Youth advocate Sarah Finnell says the adaptation of Alice in Wonderland mixes reality with fantasy.
The basic story is Alice is a 16-year-old living in Fairbanks, and a variety of things are going on in her life that are just really difficult. And she decides to leave home and go wherever she can go. Essentially, she ends up at the library, which is a pretty common place to find teens, homeless teens in Fairbanks. And then she ends up going on this ridiculous journey, just meeting a bunch of different characters.
Finnell says the message of the play is that every kid who ends up on the street has a story, and it's worth listening to. The play Alice in the Underground is a fundraiser for the street outreach program that helps homeless teens. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Michelle Terrio in Anchorage, and Shane Iverson in Bethel. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.